Welcome, everyone, to the first library outreach lecture in the spring 2017 semester. We have a full slate of outreach activities ranging from the artist series, Tuesday, February 14th. We have the writers series, Tuesday, March 14th. Scott Peters will be coming up and talking about Making Waves, Michigan's boat building industry. The artist series will be Heidi Finley. The poetry series, Jelena Rose. And that will be Tuesday, April 4th. We have a series of altered book art workshops. We also hold the Palm in the Hand memoir writing series, the first Tuesday of every month at noon. All of these are free and open to the public. And then the big thing to top everything off is we are once again holding the TEDx lecture right here in the library on March 23rd at 7 p.m. So before I introduce our speaker, I want to let everybody know that there are refreshments, coffee, tea, cookies, all kinds of good stuff. We are live streaming this and making it available for podcasts after. If everybody could turn off their phones and get ready to have an open mind, ask a lot of tough questions, I think that would be great. So now I would like to introduce our featured speaker. It's extremely my honor. I've always wanted to do this, and this is my first time I've had a chance to do it. My own brother, University of Cal Davis. I'm freaked out right now.
Aggies, go Aggies.
Agricultural econ faculty member, received his PhD from UW-Madison, and he does research all over the world, ranging from China to Africa, South America, maybe even some other places for all I know. I know that you've been to Europe. I don't know if that's fun or work.
Pleasure.
Okay. So Steve is here to talk with you about some of the research that he's done, and remember, ask tough questions.
Yeah. Hey, everyone. Thanks for coming out in this beautiful weather. And thanks to Mark and Teresa and everyone who has organized this. So what I'm going to talk about tonight, eventually we're going to get to Southern Africa, Mozambique in particular, but I'm going to start off talking about global connections related to climate change and risk in agriculture. And overall, I'll be speaking about a research project which I'm involved in, which is a 5 or 6 year time horizon, and we're about in year two. So we're relatively early into our research project, so I'm not going to have any big results for you yet. What I want to do is essentially lay out the research questions and think of the big topics that we're trying to address and the learning agenda that we're trying to promote. So, as I said, this is a big project, and I just want to let you know I'm a very small part of our overall research team. So we have several other professors from UC Davis. We have a lot of grad students. I was just at a wedding of Jonathan in Minneapolis. We graciously agreed to let Jonathan come back from Mozambique to get married in Minneapolis just last weekend. We were sending him back to Mozambique in a couple of weeks. And our primary research partner globally is CIMMYT, which is the International Center for Wheat and Maize Improvement. And these are our collaborators in Zimbabwe, Tanzania, and Mozambique. So again, this is a very big, very much a team effort, of which I'm just a small part. Okay, so as I said, I want to start off with some global connections, thinking about climate change. So let me ask you guys. So when you hear the word El Niño, or the term El Niño, what does that mean to you guys? And I want last three rows. Yeah, you guys, come on. Okay, so when you hear El Niño, what image that evoke? What does it mean? Yeah, go for it. Warm winter. Warm winter where? In Northern Hemisphere, okay? Anyone want to add to that? Because, yeah, that's where we're headed. Okay, so El Niño. So exactly. So El Niño is the warm part of what's called the El Niño Southern Oscillation, or ENSO. So our ocean currents shift between warm and and cool temperatures approximately every 2 to 7 years. And it's during these warm periods, which are associated with, are called El Niño, that we get warm weather, lots of precipitation for here in the U.S., in particular in the western U.S., and western South America. And as we'll see, why this is important globally for the region that I'm going to be talking about is that we're learning that this is also associated with hotter and drier conditions in eastern and southern Africa. And then, as we said, it's an oscillation or changes from warm to cooler climates or surface water temperatures in the ocean. And so in those opposite periods of cooler surface water temperatures, that's called La Niña, and the opposite results obtained in those years. In December of 2016, there was a really important article that came out summarizing some recent research. This came out in the Bulletin of American Meteorological Society. And so this is a picture that demonstrates or depicts the El Niño Southern Oscillation. And so let me just show you what this figure is trying to depict. So the horizontal axis is the years, going from 1900 all the way to about 2015, as we go from left to right. The midpoint of the vertical axis, or the zero point, is normal surface water temperature on the Pacific Ocean. And more specifically, we're talking about the tropical Pacific, so from kind of, think northern Peru up to about Central America. The brown lines going vertically represent years in which the surface water temperatures are warmer than normal, right? And so we see, for example, here in 2015, most recently, surface water temperatures were over 2 degrees warmer than normal. That's a huge amount, right? And in the blue years, surface water temperatures are colder than normal. Okay? So these are the years associated with El Niño, and these are the years associated with La Niña. And so I want to point out a couple of things here. So the first thing is we see this cycle of quite severe El Niño events, right, which occur every, say, 15 to 20 years. Okay? 1983, California witnessed some of the worst flooding in its history. 1997, I was actually doing my dissertation work in the northern Pacific coast of Peru, some of the worst flooding in its history. 2015, I was in California, and we were hoping to get some of the worst flooding in history because we've been suffering from a very extended drought. We had a relatively normal year in terms of rainfall, although this year it seems that we're starting to catch up. Okay, so every 15 or 20 years, we get relatively severe El Niño events. So what this research shows is three key things, right? So number one, you can see the red line is trending upwards, right? So since 1960 or so, the intensity of El Niño events is becoming much more severe. Okay? And there's relatively little doubt why that is, right? This is the result of human-induced global warming. And third, what this research has established is that these El Niño events, while we typically focus on the impacts in the U.S. And the Western Hemisphere, we see that undoubtedly they are associated with opposite and equally dramatic events in eastern and southern Africa. Okay, so in eastern and southern Africa, we get much hotter than normal temperature and severe drought. Okay, and that's what I'm going to be talking about today. Okay? Why that's so important is that when we think about sub-Saharan Africa, we're talking about a region in which a very large fraction of the population is rural, depends on subsistence agriculture, and is already quite vulnerable, even in relatively good years. So when we add on climate stress and increased drought severity, then we're talking about potentially real life and death situations for an important fraction of the population. Okay, so the crop I want to focus on is maize, corn. Okay. So let's take a step back and think about corn in the world. It's one of the most important crops, of course, globally. So this first figure shows the colors indicate the relative rank of maize in acreage in each country. And so the red areas show the countries in which maize is number one in terms of acreage, including the U.S., Mexico, Central America, not surprisingly. But we also see a large red area in sub-Saharan Africa, okay? Particularly eastern and southern Africa, where maize is king in terms of area grown. Very, very important in terms of area planted. Now, in terms of human consumption, what this figure is showing is the red countries are where are the countries in which maize is the primary, the most important source of calories in people's diets. So where do we see maize most important? Once again, not surprisingly, Mexico and Central America, and again, Eastern and Southern Africa. Okay, extremely important, the number one source of nutrients and calories in those regions. In most places, many places in sub-Saharan Africa, maize accounts for up to 30-40% of total caloric intake for households. Extremely, extremely important. As we've seen, sub-Saharan Africa, maize is really important in terms of area planted, extremely important in terms of nutrition. Over 300 million people in sub-Saharan Africa rely primarily on maize for their livelihoods, okay, both for consumption and for their incomes. So it's of critical importance to the region. Okay. If we look, however, at global maize corn production, we see one African country. So this is last year's maize production. 36% of global production comes from the U.S. China has become a huge player over the last 15 to 20 years. So they're about 22%. And then it drops down to 8% in Brazil, Europe 7%, etc. Okay. South Africa accounts for 1%. That's the only country we see depicted here. The rest of the countries in sub-Saharan Africa, even though they dedicate huge areas to maize, right, their production is essentially negligible in terms of global total global production. Okay. So what's going on? Yields suck, right? Yields are really, really low. Okay, so let's take a look at that just to get a perspective. So these are maize yields in the key maize-producing countries in sub-Saharan Africa from 1990 to 2014. So a couple things I want to point out. Number one, for some of the countries, most important is Ethiopia and Nigeria, so it's the blue and the green lines, also Uganda, the gold line, we see a relatively increasing trend here. So maize yields, again, what are yields? Value output, in this case, sorry, this is kilograms per hectare. Okay. So it's production divided by year. Okay. So trends are slightly upwardly increasing over this period, although not very strongly. In the other countries, including Mozambique and Zimbabwe, trend is actually flat. So we don't see strong yield gains. Okay. Okay. Let's throw in the primary maize producing countries in the world. U.S. Rises over this period from about 7 metric tons to over 10 tons per hectare. Okay. So we're talking about somewhere in the U.S. yields are anywhere from 4 to 10 times the value of yields in these sub-Saharan countries that we're talking. Okay, so huge, huge yield gaps. And of course, that's U.S. With the highest yields in the world. But we see that China, look at the gains that China has made, right? More than doubling their yields over that period. Brazil has had some slight gains, but their starting point was quite a bit higher. Okay, so one of the key questions that economists and agronomists and crop scientists and all types of people struggled with is, how can we close this yield gap? What's driving these very, very low yields in sub-Saharan Africa for maize? This critical, critical thing.
All right. One of the main reasons is improved varieties are very rarely used by farmers, small farmers in particular in sub-Saharan. They're available to a large degree, but they're not used. So somebody give me some potential reasons why farmers in sub-Saharan Africa are not using high-yielding. Are we going to let Mark ask questions or give answers? Hi, bro. Mark, you said it very well, but let's differentiate two points. Okay. So price. Okay. Whether the maize is from Syngenta, Monsanto, or a local African seed-producing company, high-yielding varieties, which are hybrids or open pollination varieties, are expensive. Right? Certified seed is expensive relative to locally available and traditional maize varieties. Okay. And I'll talk about that in just a second. So that's one question. The second is, and this is a really important question, is can you reuse the seed? Okay. And in these countries in sub-Saharan Africa, the issue is not so much intellectual property rights. Okay. It's not so much that, well, you have a Monsanto seed, therefore you're not allowed to reuse it or give seed to somebody else. It's more a question of if I'm using a hybrid variety, right? Hybrid varieties lose their reproductive capacity very quickly. Okay, so if you plant a hybrid in year one, you get 4 tons per hectare. You replant in year two, your yield is going to drop tremendously. By year three, you're not going to get any. Okay. So those are two issues, certainly, right, cost and can you reuse seeds? Okay, good question. So what's an improved variety? So I'm going to call an improved variety, basically certified seed, and it can either be hybrid, right, or it can be open pollination variety, OPV. Right? So open pollination variety is exactly that. So these are maize that pollinates, and you can reuse OPV seeds. And the difference between OPV and hybrids is that, can you reuse them? Yes or no? And it's yield. So open pollination varieties have lower yield, right? But you can reuse them. Hybrids, higher yield, you can't reuse them. So by improved variety, we're talking about certified seeds, yes, sold by either big or small companies. Okay. So we have Mark's the only one that's given me possible reasons why farmers, small farmers in sub-Saharan Africa aren't using these seeds. So I agree, but tell me a bit more. What are you thinking about?
Probably in the culture, it's probably was depth and you just use these certain types of seeds and behavior and passage here.
So if you didn't hear back there, what he said, and this is a really important reason, is just culture. Right? So local varieties use, let me unpack culture just a little bit. So, number one, maize seeds are very context specific. The yield you get depends very much on your local agroclimatic conditions. Okay, and so seeds that may work really well in this village may not work well at all in this village over here. So they may evolve a tradition of certain types of seeds and seed sharing amongst villagers, right? The second thing is local maize varieties are all open pollination varieties. In other words, they can be reused year after year. Okay, and so you do end up using seeds and seed exchanges, right, within the culture as ways of kind of ensuring each other. Right? So if I've had a good year, you've had a bad year, I may give you some seeds so that you can plant again next year. Okay. So another important reason, a cultural component, is consumption. Right? So traditional varieties have evolved to meet local consumption demand. And in Africa, what does this mean? It means the way that you grind the corn matters, right? How grindable, how easily grindable it is matters for the taste of the cornmeal that's consumed every day. So all of these things actually are very important in terms of culture. Okay, anything else?
So if you're already at a low relative income, your willingness to take risk with those higher yield seeds, you may not want to take that risk because you only have X number of dollars to be able to spend through the year, and it just so happens that it's a bad year, you put all your money in. So I guess the question is how risk averse the culture is.
So how risk averse you are and what you can do if things go bad. In other words, how well you can insure yourself. Right? Perfect. I did not pay him for that answer. Okay. All right. But I'm going to show you. We'll come to that. Okay. All right. So here's some typical reasons, right? So Mark said, if they're expensive. Yep. Okay. But we're talking about pretty poor farmers. They don't have a lot of cash on hand and they don't have access to a lot of credit. Okay. So they may not be able to purchase them. To get the benefits of improved varieties, you need to add some fertilizer. Fertilizer is expensive. Counterfeit seeds and fake fertilizers are a big deal in sub-Saharan Africa now. Right? So there's a lot of traders who go around and collect local seeds and then color them. Right? So improved varieties, I'll show you some pictures, they're like they're red or they're green. Right? Okay. And so traders will go around, get cheap conventional seeds, paint them, sell them like as if they were hybrids. Okay? Yeah. And they sell them at really high prices. And farmers know this, and so they don't trust the sellers. Fertilizer dealers doctor up the fertilizer. They add sand. They don't put the correct NPK, right, nitrogen, phosphorus. What's the last one? Let's see. Potassium, thank you. Right? They don't put the right ratios in. So there's a lot of missing trust in the input markets. If you're going to grow improved varieties well, if you're going to switch from a traditional variety to an improved variety, you've got to do some things a little bit differently, or a lot differently, actually. And if you don't have people come around and teach you how to do them differently, that's a problem. Okay? And indeed, extension systems in sub-Saharan Africa are extremely weak. Okay, and then the big one that I'm going to talk about is exactly the one that Mark pointed out, which is how can I risk spending $50, $60, $70, which is a lot of money, on seeds to plant a couple hectares of maize, right, when that's the amount of money I need to send my kids to school, okay, if there's a chance that I'm not going to get a return on my investments because of weather or because of some other source of risk. Okay. So it's a big decision, it's expensive, so people who are risk averse and who don't have insurance may not decide to. Okay. All right. So I'm talking a little bit about drought risk and poverty traps. Okay, let's think a little bit more about what Mark was helping us think about in terms of this potentially very problematic issue of lack of insurance, and people are averse to risk, and therefore that can lead to underinvestment, amongst other things. Okay, again, so what we said is in sub-Saharan Africa, farmers face a lot of climate risk, but that's of course not the only risk. There's all types of risks that they face. They face market risk. Prices fluctuate all the time. You've seen that they face risk of getting dealt fake seeds, fake fertilizers. They face risk from conflict and violence. So in Mozambique right now, which I'll talk about in just a few minutes, the civil war ended in 1992. The country was growing very well for 15, 20 years. In the last 2 years, political unrest has risen again. And in a lot of areas, people are afraid to plant their farms, right, because they don't know if the war is going to come back. Okay. So political conflict and violence is a very big risk as well. Households have, in general, no irrigation. So we're talking about rain-fed farming. They depend on the rain. And as we saw, drought frequency and intensity is high and increasing. Okay, so there's a lot of sources of risk. Risk is one of the central features of life to households that farm in sub-Saharan Africa. Okay, so there's two ways I want to talk about, I want to get you guys to think about in terms of how risks such as climate stress can drive poverty and poverty traps. Okay, we'll talk about ex post and ex ante. So the first one is ex post is kind of the obvious one. So what happens, what do households do after a drought comes, okay, to deal with drought? So here's a stylized example. Imagine we have three, poor household, single mother, lots of children, a little bit of maize, and two cows. Drought comes, wipes out the maize crop. Our less poor household, two working people, fewer children, more hectares in maize, and a larger herd of cattle. Okay? So, how might you imagine these two households may differ in their response, how they're going to deal with a drought? Any ideas? Yeah.
Whether it's used other things to sell off certain things.
Okay, so number one thing we do is we start selling off assets. Right? Because we want to do, what we'd love to do is protect our consumption. Right? One way to do that is to sell off our assets. Right? So, again, I want to pay the school fees, I want to make sure that my kids have enough to eat every day. That requires cash. Right? I've had total harvest failure, so I have no income to get cash. So what do? I can sell off a cow, I can sell off some goats. Okay. Who's more likely to do that? The poor household or the less poor household? To use that strategy of selling off assets. The poor household. So that's what we might think. But what happens if our poor household sells off their two cows to feed the kids today? They're going to starve to death in the future. Right? So you sell off your cows today. Right? It's taken generations to get my livestock, to get to buy these cows. It's going to be extremely difficult to build those asset stocks back up in the future. Okay? So, and I think it's exactly the intuitive thing. Okay? But there's a ton of research that shows that it's the less poor households, they definitely do that. Right? They're going to sell up two or three cows and maintain kind of the minimum amount of assets, right, that allow them to continue to be okay in the future. Right? But if that really poor household sells off their cows, they're done in the future. So what do? They hold on to their cow and they feed their kids less. They pull their kids out of school. Okay? This is extremely costly. Right? It's extremely costly in the long run. Right? The long-term consequences are, show you the research on this. Okay. So when our really poor household holds on to its cow and instead gives half portion of maize instead of a full portion to its kids, pulls the kids out of school, what happens? Right. So we see growth of children slows. This third bullet point down here is really important. We see younger children, right, under 5 years old, become stunted. Right? So stunted meaning that they're in the lower 5% of height for age. Right? And that's a very, very strong indication of cognitive development and long-term potential. Okay? And those end up being relatively permanent impacts, permanent consequences. Yeah, Mark?
So, listening to what you're saying, it seems to me that one of the ways to alleviate this problem would be way back, and I don't know the solution, obviously, but is if you had a system of public education where you don't have to pay for it, and then you don't have to take your kids out of school because it's already paid for by society.
So their schools are public. They're going to public schools, but they still have to buy books, backpacks. They still have some minimal school fees. But they also pull kids out of school to send them to work. Okay. So my main point here is that when a drought comes and we have a very vulnerable household, then the ex post or after the drought, how I deal with the drought, for the poor can be extremely damaging in the long run. Right? So basically what the family is doing is protecting those few assets that they have, right, so that this current generation can survive into the future. But this is coming at the cost of the next generation. Okay, so this is an intergenerational transmission of poverty. Okay, so this is one very important form of... So, I think the parts of Africa that you're referring to a large degree, are herders who do depend on kind of seasonal migration. And as climate change occurs, then that lifestyle becomes completely unviable. And so they have to move. In the place that we're going to talk about, Tanzania, in particular Mozambique, there's definitely the beginnings of mass migration out of these areas.
Sure, like Egypt, right? North Africa.
Sure.
It's not a place of civilizations, if you'll say. The point is that they don't seem to have that problem.
Yeah, so, and part of that, so, how do we attribute that, and how much is that attributable to climate, how much of that is attributable to in the case of Mozambique, political turmoil, conflict, violence, it's hard to say. Okay, so point number one, vulnerability to severe drought, other types of risks, can have very long-term negative consequences and drive poverty trends because of these exposed reactions. And the second, actually, let me just show you this real quickly. So this is, in the case of Mozambique, so the blue bars represent the percent of stunting in children under 5 in Mozambique, right? And it hasn't declined very much at all, right? From 1995 to 2011, we're talking 40 to 60%. It's a huge...
Yeah. Out of curiosity, what is like the average number of children in the
The household size, and we have a survey of about 1,500 rural households. Average household size is about 7.5. And of those 5 are under 18.
That's a lot of people.
Yep. Okay. The second mechanism by which risk, such as drought, can drive poverty traps is the anti-behavioral mechanism. And this is what Mark was pointing to. The threat of drought will lead me to invest less. And if I'm investing less, then of course my yields and my returns are going to be lower. So on average, I'm going to be making less income, and it's going to be more difficult to pull myself up. Okay, so we have ex post and ex ante reasons by which risks such as that from climate stress and drought can lead to poverty traps. Okay, so it's a long way of saying we have risk driving this potentially vicious cycle of poverty. Okay, and so the question then is, what can be done to break this risk poverty trap cycle? I'm going to talk about two different technological innovations that have become very popular over the last 10 to 15 years. And there's, of course, a ton of work from so many different disciplines, so many different angles. I'm going to talk just about two of them.
Okay. I just have a question.
Yeah.
How many have to sort of
rotations do you have to have?
What do you have to have?
So you need, in that area of the world, you need about 2.5 to 3 hectares of maize. And if you get an average yield for that part of the world, you can survive.
So what's the average
crop size of the maize? About that. In maize. And they have some other crops as well. It depends. Certainly, I mean, there's variability. Some do. Okay, so the two technologies I want to talk about, one is biological, so it's seeds. Okay, drought-tolerant maize varieties. Okay. And the second one is a financial market innovation, which is a new form of insurance which is designed to be able to reach previously uninsurable households. Okay, and this is called index insurance. All right. So first, let me talk quickly about drought-tolerant maize. So drought-tolerant maize there's been a lot of research put in the last 20 years or so, basic research on the development of these varieties by two of the CGIARs. This is the Collaborative Group on International Agricultural Research. And so this set of institutions, most of them are crop-specific, so we have the International Potato Institute in Peru, we have the International Rice Research Institute, the Philippines, CIMIT, which is the Spanish acronym for the International Maize and Wheat Improvement Center, is based in Mexico City, but it has a large office in Africa, and then we have International Institute for Tropical Agriculture. So they have been responsible for a lot of this research. And what I'm going to talk about here is a two-stage project called Drought-Tolerant Maize for Africa. So the first stage, 2006 to 2015, is basically the developmental phase. This is in the lab, this is plant scientists, and some field tests, and the beginning of marketing to farmers. And I'll tell you more in just a second. And stage two, which is just beginning now, is the scale-up. And so it's getting these seeds out to farmers, okay, and building sustainable markets. Okay, so stage one. It's funded primarily by Gates Foundation, working in 13 countries, the main maize-producing countries in sub-Saharan Africa. And basically, plant breeders at CIMIT work together with plant breeders from each of the national agricultural research institutions in those 13 countries to develop, what's their goal? They want to develop locally varieties that are would bear high yields but be resistant to drought in the specific agroecological conditions of each sub-region within each of these countries. Okay, that's the goal. How do they do it? I honestly don't know exactly. Okay? But I'm going to give you basic idea. right? So we're talking about, and I put this up here to please Mark, right? So we're talking about traditional breeding methods. Okay? We're not talking about GMOs. So we're talking about crossing native varieties, okay, to develop new varieties with these traits. Shorter overall cycle, plants that stay green longer, that you continue photosynthesis and providing energy to the plant, and most importantly, they want to build resistance to mid-season drought. This is what's crucial for drought risk in sub-Saharan Africa. All right, so why mid-season drought? What's so important about mid-season drought? So here's a picture of the maize cycle. What we're talking about is this critical period of tasseling and silking, right, when pollination occurs. And how does it actually occur? Okay, so basically, the male flowers, the tassel, release pollen, which is then caught, absorbed, right, by the female flowers, which are the ears, right? In particular, they're caught by the silks, right, from the ears. The silks then transfer the pollen to the ovules for fertilization, right, and each ovule develops into a kernel. Okay. So the problem with drought during this period is that the silks dry out and prevent pollinization from happening. Okay. So what these guys, these plant breeds, are trying to develop are varieties that are less resistant, right, to silk drying out and to this problem of mid-season drought. Okay, so what are the results from stage one, from this basic research? Very good. 160 new drought-tolerant maize varieties were developed and released, combination of hybrids and open pollination varieties. They've conducted lots of field trials in relatively controlled conditions that show very optimistic results. What are they? Under normal rainfall conditions, these drought-tolerant varieties perform at least as well as the best commercial varieties out there. Most importantly, under moderate drought, when there's moderate mid-season drought, they do much better. They maintain yields. Okay, that's what they're going for. Very important to acknowledge, however, that under severe drought, they fail just like other varieties out there. Okay, so there's some and the biological insurance built in, but it's not perfect. Okay, all right. Damn it, Jim, I'm an economist. Yes, it's carbohydrate. Look, corn is not the most nutritious food, right? But it provides, its carbohydrates, its calories, right? So is it as nutritious as other varieties of maize? I have no idea, to be quite honest. I suspect there's not that much of a difference. Now, there's other research being carried out by these research institutes that is doing biofortified maize, right? So you have orange maize where you're injecting vitamin, which vitamin makes it orange? B? C? One of those, okay? So that it's much more directed at, yes. But these are not doing that. These are drought resistant. Okay. Okay. All right. So, any first stage results are good. Seeds look good, at least in field trials under controlled conditions. That's important, right? They've engaged lots of national seed-producing companies, which is going to be very important if this is going to be a sustainable market over time. They have created a maize germplasm center in Kenya, which will allow seed companies to continue to develop additional lines and additional varieties. At cost, okay? So they're not charging huge fees. They want this to be, this research to be ongoing at a sustainable cost. Okay, second stage is to scale this up. Okay, so we've now developed maize varieties. How do we get these out to farms? So the project is working with local seed companies, both to improve and increase their capacity to produce seed, and to do field trials and to market it to farmers. Now, the second stage is focusing only on 5 of the 13 original countries, including the one I'll talk about, Mozambique. All right. Second technology, financial, it's index insurance. All right. Let me go to this picture, and I'm going to talk to tell you what index insurance is. Let me tell you first what index insurance is not. Index insurance is not conventional crop insurance. It's not conventional multi-peril or named peril crop insurance. This is a picture of the implementation of conventional insurance. We have a separate project in the highlands of Ecuador. This is a potato farm. This is like the only company in Ecuador that offers conventional crop insurance. And what do I mean by that? So the guy on the left in the hoodie is the farmer. He has an insurance policy given by this claims adjuster, Leonardo. The farmer called up Leonardo and said, "We had a major drought here. My potato harvest is coming in very, very poorly. I want you to come up and give me a payout, right? Because I have an insurance policy." Leonardo went up, drove about 7 hours to get to this tiny little potato plot. And what is he doing? He's pulling up a couple of potato plants. Why is he pulling up these potato plants? He's pulling up because he doesn't trust the farmer. Right? Why doesn't he trust the farmer? Because he doesn't believe that the poorly developed potato plants were a result of drought. He thinks they were probably the result of neglect by the farmer. How is he going to prove that? He pulls up this potato plant and he says, "Hey, you've had a drought, right? You've had a drought. Therefore, if you fertilize, when I pull this potato plant up, I should see a whole bunch of fertilizer granules in the roots, right? Because you haven't had any rain to dissolve those fertilizer granules." Right? So he pulled it up, saw no fertilizer, and indeed, the farmer said, "You caught me. You're right." Okay. He didn't make a payout. Okay, this is a long way of describing two of the huge challenges of offering this type of conventional crop insurance to small farmers in developing countries. Okay. Number one, he's got to drive all the way out to this farm to verify damages on the field. Huge expense. Number two, he has to verify that if the damages are actually there, that they were caused by the insured events, not by farmer neglect. Right? Very, very difficult, very, very expensive. The only reason that Leonardo and his company are doing this is because they're receiving huge subsidies from the government to do it. Okay? In general, we simply don't see this type of conventional crop insurance contract for smallholders in developing countries. It doesn't exist. Okay? All right. So that doesn't exist. What does exist? Or what might be an example of, let me give you an example of index insurance as an alternative. Okay, then I'll tell you a bit more systematically. So I'm going to give you this example. We're working on this contract for index insurance with the Coffee Federation of Colombia. They have no insurance for the crops. They're subject to all types of climate risk. And so we're working with them to develop index insurance products. Here's how it works. So coffee, really complex, right? One of the key moments is again flowering, right? Because each flower develops into a fruit, which develops into a coffee bean. Okay? Flowering requires a dry spell. If you get too much moisture, too much rainfall during the flowering period, flowering doesn't happen. Therefore, yields drop tremendously. Okay? So that's a big risk to coffee farmers. Here's how the index insurance contract works. We're going to measure rainfall, right, at government rainfall stations throughout the coffee region. If rainfall nearest to your farm is greater than 200 millimeters, okay, in the key flowering months, then anybody who purchased this index insurance contract gets a payout. Okay? No matter what happened on your individual farm. Okay? Okay, so it doesn't require an insurance agent to go out and check yields on anybody's farm. Okay. All it requires is measurement of rainfall at a rainfall station. That's it. Okay? Okay. So again, fee does not require measurement of individual losses. Instead, it's going to make a common payment to any farmer who bought the insurance, and that payment is going to be based on the level of an index, in our example, rainfall, and that index has to be correlated with farmers' losses, right? Okay. So, advantages of index insurance. Very, very small transaction costs, because all we have to do, we get the data from the rainfall station. That's it. We don't have to go out and measure yields on individual farms. Okay, and then we have no moral hazard and adverse selection. It's just we're preserving incentives for farmers to manage their crop well. Okay, I'm going to skip this in interest of time. Okay, but that's the basic idea. Okay. Index insurance, the tremendous potential here to reach smallholders is that we don't have to go through the huge transaction costs of visiting farms. That's verified data. Very, very powerful concept. Okay. What this is saying basically is it's not easy to find a good index, it's not easy to write a good contract, but the potential is there. Okay. What we've been turning to more and more in the last decade or so, and index insurance is actually not a new idea. So the U.S. index-based insurance has been around for a long time. In developing countries, it's a new idea. It hasn't been implemented until basically the 2000s. So it's gotten lots of play in developing countries recently. What's gotten lots and lots of play very recently are satellite-based indices. So we have these satellites going around. They can measure all types of things, including rainfall, including vegetative growth, right, which will help us give a good estimate of what average yields in the region are. Okay, so we can use satellite imagery in order to see how well crops are doing. Okay, and therefore, we can write contracts, insurance contracts, based on the satellite imagery. Okay. And this is just an example, a place we're working in Tanzania. Over here on the right, these are just pixels, right, which we have information from satellites on each of those pixels, and the level of greenness tells us about, in this case, it's normalized vegetative index, basically the density of plant growth, okay, in each of those regions, which is strongly correlated with yields. Okay, so the more green it is, the higher our yields in that area. So basically, you can write a contract that says, hey, if you have a farm, right, in this district comprised of these three pixels, and if greenness is, or the color is very green this year, that means your yields were pretty high, so we're not going to give you a payout. If instead you're in one of these, right, where it's less green, this means yields were pretty low, so we're going to give you a payout. We're not going to visit anybody's farm. All we're going to do is we're going to utilize satellite information, which is publicly and freely available. Absolutely. That's a really interesting question. So the question was, how much subsidy is required to make this type of index insurance contract work? And I divide that into two pieces. One is the development of the contract. So there's a lot of research that has to go in to developing the index itself. Right? So what exact satellite information are we going to use? What's going to be the spatial dimension of our contract? Things like that. Most of the index insurance contracts that have been offered in the developing world have been about 100% subsidized under research and development of it. The contract that I'll show you in just a second, I'll get there very quickly, in Mozambique. Right, so we developed it. The researchers developed it. Okay, because we work with departments and researchers that are experts in satellite imagery. So we actually develop the contract. We then present this contract to local insurance companies, and they say, oh yeah, that looks good, or no, we don't like this contract. Right? then offering of the contract to farmers, so the premium itself, in the contract we're offering, there's no subsidy. In the premium itself. So all the subsidy is in the research and development and creation. In other examples, in the Columbia case, the government is offering about a 40 or 50% subsidy to the premium itself. So it varies across depending on where you are. So it depends very much on the contract itself. The one that I'll show you in Mozambique, we're starting very small, and it's actually going to cover only the cost of the seed. Okay, precisely because these farmers can't afford a large insurance payment, especially because insurance premiums have to be paid up front. Right? In other contexts, obviously it depends on how much coverage you're asking for. In our case, we're going to start out very small, covering only the seed, the value of the seed. Okay. All right. Okay. So we've talked about the big problem, the risk-induced poverty trap. We've talked about two technologies to break this risk-poverty trap cycle: DT, drought-tolerant seeds, and index insurance. So what are we doing in the research program? Here's our questions. All right, so can these drought-tolerant maize varieties increase investments, yields, and ultimately improve human nutrition and development outcomes among vulnerable populations? And two, does the provision of an index insurance contract, right, that manages the extreme drought that the DT seeds can't deal with, right, does that improve the uptake and make the results of drought-tolerant seeds even better? Okay, and we have a parallel research program in Tanzania and Mozambique. Mark, I'm going to ask you, and stop for a second, how on time, what do we
do?
Okay, all right. So, what I want to do is just show you who we're working with locally, okay? To show you how we're doing this. So to do this, right, we have to get these seeds out there. Right? We don't develop the seeds. Right? And we have to get the insurance out there. Right? We as researchers can't offer insurance. For both cases, we have to go through private sector and markets. Okay. So in Mozambique, we're working with two local seed companies. Okay, this is Phoenix Seed Company, relatively small seed company, and they're producing the open pollination variety of DT seeds. It's called ZM523. Okay, it costs about 80 cents per kilo, yield potential 3 to 4 tons per hectare. Okay, there's the owner. Kevin is the owner of Phoenix Seeds. He's actually a transplant from Zimbabwe, and he owns a large farm where he produces lots of seeds. The second seed company is Klein Cruz, an international company with headquarters in South Africa. They're producing the hybrid variety, CRISP 601. So you can see it's much more expensive, almost 3 times as expensive, but it has higher yields if you accompany it with the appropriate fertilizers. Okay, so the yield potentials are higher. Okay. And these guys in the top picture are the local managers in Mozambique of Klein Cruz. And we've got an insurance company that we're working with, right? So we marketed this insurance contract to a bunch of insurance companies in Mozambique and said, hey, who wants to participate? Right? We've designed the contract. We need somebody to offer it. Who's going to do it? So this company, Hollard, which is also based in South Africa but has regional coverage throughout the region, they have virtually no agricultural experience, but they said, hey, actually, we'd like to be the first movers in this market. So we want to get a foot in the door, see how this works, do some experimentation. We're going to go for it. Okay, so we're working with Hollard to offer the insurance. Here's how the insurance contract works. As we said, in these first couple of years, we're only insuring the seed, okay, the seed itself. Now, that may not sound like much, but it's actually the primary cash outlay that these farmers have to make. And what farmers want to know is, if my crop fails this year, how am I going to be able to replant next year? Well, if their seed is guaranteed through insurance, that's how they're going to do it. So that's how we're appealing to them. And there's the cost. The insurance is 20% of the cost. Okay, so concretely, that's about 16 cents per kg for the open pollination variety or 40 cents per kg for the hybrid.
That's all very high. So I'm wondering if that is a deterrent to having farmers pick up this.
So one of our big questions is, we want to answer that question. Is that going to deter, how, in econ speak, how price elastic, how price sensitive, is farmer demand for seed? Okay. We think that it's not going to make that much of a difference.
The seed produces a lot more.
Right. So if the seed produces a lot more, you can do it. But Mark's talking about the insurance itself, right? We're talking 20% of the seed cost. So the question, are they going to be willing to pay 20% higher seed costs for this insurance, right, for the seed guarantee? Right? We're going to find out. Right? That's part of the research agenda.
How much of it goes to profit? Because I'm kind of interested in that. These are people who companies and they're not doing it.
So it's a great question. Here's a rough breakdown of, let's say, the 16 cents per kg. So about 10 cents covers the purest green, right? Which is, right, in about 1 out of 7 or 8 years, they're going to have to make a payout to farmers, right? So 10 cents covers that, okay? The rest is administration and profit. Okay? So they're, right. They're not doing it out of the goodness of their hearts. This is a business.
So they have no kind of insurance, so like, say, if they, do they lose pesticides?
So the farmers that we're working with in Mozambique, fertilizer, about 2% needs chemical fertilizer. Even less needs pesticides.
So are they doing everything by hand? I mean, like, are they, like,
about 10%, 15% use animal traction. The rest hand plow.
Wow.
What do you know is what most people do is retail
sports. So in these regions, in a normal year, yields are about 700-800 kg per hectare. Really low. But this is with the traditional seeds, right? So in theory, if they buy the drought-tolerant improved varieties, and if they buy and apply fertilizer, right, they could be tripling, quadrupling, right? It could be. Now, whether or not they're going to do that is an open question, right? And that's another large part of the research agenda, right? So in order for them to really realize the benefits of these new seeds, these new varieties, they're part of the issues, they're going to have to sink some additional investment.
I realize this is my last question. So
does anybody believe Mark?
Yeah, no. As there's more corn for maize on the market, as more people do this, is that going to decrease the price per bushel or whatever? It's not the most of it, it's for self-consumption, but whatever that extra amount is, if there's more people doing that,
Why didn't you become an economist?
I'm not as smart as you.
This is a general equilibrium effect, right?
Yeah.
So if a ton of people adopt this new technology, yields go way up, flood the market, will prices drop? We're a long way off from that right now. Okay. In the future, maybe an issue. We're far, far away from that right now.
You know, I wonder if you could work with that. The farmers a few seeds for like a test to show like that their seeds are working, but it also get the farmers buying because of the new weather.
Okay, so let me see. There it was. So here's our research program. Year one, which was 2015-16, so the maize growing season in Mozambique is December through May. So in September, October, November of 2015, we were, this is our baseline year, we're out in all these villages doing information sessions and giving free small trial packs. So we're priming the pump. Okay, that's exactly what we did. Okay. December through May is the growing season, and then after harvest, we're out there doing in-depth household surveys, right? Some yields, nutrition, all these outcomes that we're interested in. Okay, so here's what an information session at the village looks like. Here are the trial seed packs. Okay, these are the Phoenix open pollination varieties. Okay, and then right, we're demonstrating what different techniques they have to use for these improved varieties compared to the traditional varieties. Like, what are the recommendations from the seed companies themselves in terms of spacing between plants, depth of planting, and number of seeds per hole, for example.
Are they recommending fertilizers and
So why is that said? Because in order for them to get yield benefits, right, they have to improve the soil. Right, there's two ways to do that. Right. You can apply organic material, right? That takes a long time, right? Okay. Or you can use chemicals. Depends who you ask, right? So, I mean, the levels of fertilizer we're talking about here are so low, right, that nobody here is talking about environmental concerns or health concerns from fertilizer pesticide law. Not yet. But again, there's orders of magnitude, right? There's for local politicians, for international aid groups, right? Order of magnitude number one is feeding models, right? So they've got to raise yields, right? So we'll see what happens. Okay, so that's what we're doing, and then our core treatment is what are we doing? So we have two types of treatment villages. In our first type of treatment villages, we're giving, we're going out and we're selling the DT, the drought tolerant varieties to farmers. We're making it available. Right? So we're taking, the research team is actually taking the seed out to the villages, talking about the seed, and making it available for purchase. We have another set of villages in which we're doing that, plus we're offering this insurance. Okay, so great question. So one, we're starting off, again, we want to start this off as simply as we can. The insurance is only available if you buy the seeds. Okay, so it's bundled. It's bundled with the seeds. Okay, so it means during our research project, right? So in these second groups of villages, if you want these seeds, it comes with the insurance. We're not giving them the option to buy the seeds without the insurance. Okay. In this other set of villages, they're only getting offered the seed. They're not getting offered the insurance. Right. And then, of course, in the third set of villages, which are our control villages, they're getting nothing. Right. I know that sounds horrible, but that's.
Yeah, but the idea of that going, that avoids that problem we have
So actually, this is. So it's a great point, and I'm not going to claim that this bundling of insurance with seed is our original idea. There's actually a really interesting initiative in Tanzania, Ethiopia, and Kenya. Which is insurance bundling with seed. It's not necessarily index-based insurance, right? But it's pushed by the seed companies, and it's precisely to overcome issues of trust by farmers, right? Because if the seed's guaranteed, right, then...
But they're not going to sell me bad seed if it's guaranteed. So the question is how much Gates money goes into sub-Saharan Africa? I don't have the figures off the top of my head, but it's hundreds of millions of dollars. Yes. So this is an issue we face in our research program, which is there's lots of different development projects going on at the same time. Right? One of them is a large-scale project on no-till agriculture, sustainable farming, and primary objective is to get green manure turned into the soil and food soil. So yeah, that's what I'm saying. Okay. All right, so that's the research program at Rock Selling Seeds. Let me wrap up. Let me just show you these results. So just in October, November of a couple months ago, we had our first round of seed sales. Okay, and what did we find? So the percent of households that purchased any of these improved drought-tolerant varieties, right, was 45% in the seed-only group, about 38% in the bundled seed plus insurance villages. The amount that those households purchased is relatively small, right? We're talking less than 4 kilograms per household. Okay. Now, the recommended amount of seed per hectare, recommended by the seed companies, is about 20 kg per hectare. Now, farmers don't do that. They put much less seed than the recommended amounts, but still, we're talking about, on average, 3.5 kg, and we're doing maybe half an acre at most, maybe a quarter of an acre with this new variety of seeds, okay? But that's not too surprising, right? Farmers are not going to jump into this totally new technology and put all the eggs in one basket. They're going to ease their way into it. Okay? So we're at the beginning of this research program. We'll see what happens over time. All right, wrap up. So what did we learn? So two interesting technologies out there, right? Drought-tolerant varieties have received a huge amount of international resources to develop these drought-resistant, drought-tolerant varieties in the last 10 years. In theory, they look great. Right? They have the potential to raise yields, to provide biological insurance while maintaining strong yields under normal rainfall and doing much better than anything else out there under moderate drought. They, however, don't do well, just like any other seed, when we have these extreme events, which are becoming increasingly common. Okay, so lots of money has been invested in this biological technology. There's been a lot of attention given also to index insurance, right, to this financial side innovation, right, which has the potential, because of low transaction costs and not having to go out to verify damages on each parcel, to be able to reach at relatively low cost small farmers who have previously been uninsured. So together, these two innovations offer the potential, at least, right, to break this risk poverty trap cycle affecting millions of vulnerable households. Right? But until now, this has been potential. We want to see in this research project, now we bring these things out to the households, what's going to happen? Okay. Now when the rubber meets the road, what's going to happen? Can we rely actually on private markets, seed companies, insurance companies to deliver these technologies? And are families going to adopt sufficient quantity? Are they going to provide the, are they going to invest in the complementary inputs, right, that are needed to have
the development, the positive development impacts that we hope. These are the big questions that we're going to be exploring over time. So what are our initial impressions? Well, relatively positive to start, right? We've got excellent relationships, good participation, and willingness to innovate from the private sector side, right? Both seed company and insurance. We saw, you could either see these 40% adoption rates as half full or half empty, depending if you're optimist like Mark, right? We see these as fairly optimistic because we think, as typically happens with new technologies, that households scale up over time. And we anticipate adoption will increase. We'll see. What about the impact on household welfare? We're not sure. Obviously, with such small volumes being adopted, it's hard to imagine finding big impacts on health and nutrition to start with. But we'll see. And let me just close by returning to this issue of this being a global issue, right? We started off with the discussion of climate change. There's no doubt that human-induced climate change is intensifying, and that's driven by climate. This is not being driven by farmers in sub-Saharan Africa. Right? This is driven by the North. But who bears the brunt to a large degree is precisely vulnerable households in areas like sub-Saharan Africa who bear the brunt of the cost of climate change. So it's crucial, right, that the U.S. continues to play a leadership role in mitigating climate change, right? We need to continue and double down on efforts, scientific efforts, research, monitoring, evaluation of environmental and climate indicators. And this is really important for us right now. The index insurance contracts that we've developed rely on satellite imagery, which is in part run by NASA in the U.S. The incoming administration has already suggested that they might cut that role for NASA, right? Because they believe that NASA, they may believe, we shall see, that NASA shouldn't be in the business of monitoring climate and environment in our world. Instead, they should be only involved in deep space exploration. Hopefully that's not the case, right? But if funding gets cut to maintain these satellites, we're done. Okay, it's going to take these types of contracts off the table. And obviously, we need the U.S. to continue to honor its commitments, right, to global climate accords. Okay, I shall stop there. Sorry for going over time.
Any other questions for Dr. Boucher?
I have a question. I was just kind of wondering, how unavailable is water over there? How far is that container well?
For water?
Yeah.
Again, it depends so much on the region.
Water aquifers over there?
Yeah. So the regions that we're working in Mozambique, you have to drill down about 50 to 100 meters. Exactly. So the energy cost for them is prohibitive. So, as far as I know, again, at least in the places that we're working in Mozambique, that type of communal efforts don't take place. What you do have is extended family, and some of the regions we have is polygamous families, and so you do have kind of broader collectives that manage risk in that way. But at a broader village level, or inter-village level, it doesn't happen, as far as I know. And part of the challenge there is conflict and violence, right? Which is exacerbating precisely those types of efforts a lot.
So when do you go back?
I'll be going back in April. Yeah?
Could this place be these people, they don't have confidence in these 35 men and telling them that but they have the confidence in you.
Ooh. So number one, I would not say that they necessarily have confidence. Right? So I think that certainly we're relying on a combination of us, but primarily it is the local institutions, the local companies that have to be trusted by themselves. Right? I do think, my impression at least, is that having an international agency participate is a good thing. It tends to increase farmers' interest and trust. Now, whether it's actually increasing their trust or whether it's simply households responding to incentives in the form of, oh, gee, there's an international development program, maybe there's going to be something in it for me, so I'm going to go along with this program and get something at the end of the day. That I can't differentiate. But one thing that we do is we spend a lot of time in the villages. You have to start, but you can't do this type of research unless you establish relationships with village leadership. So you start there. You start at the provincial level, then at the district level, then to the village level. Work with the villages, explain the project. Have lots of meetings with farmers in the village, explain what we're doing. We do field days to describe and discuss the technologies. We let them ask as many questions as they want. So it's just about establishing a relationship. And again, it's not me, right? And I speak Portuguese, but in most of these places, households are not speaking Portuguese, right? So they're speaking local languages. So which is another challenge, right? We have eight different translators because eight different languages being spoken in our research. So I think the key thing is just mutual respect and it's establishing serious relationships. The fact that you come back, right? You're not just a one and done type of program is really important. So when we came back, because we told them in fall of 2015, we'll be back next year selling these seeds. We're going to be available. Like when we showed up in the village of the book, you may get from that. That's cool. I think that's big for them because for them to go to the district capital where the agro dealers' input supply stores are, that's hard. It's expensive for them. So the fact that we're going out there and then undoing our promises. So we'll see. That's a really, really good question.
I know with everything you talked about, it had really big impact. Growing
of the
corn, but what about the terrain? You said that
you
have to drill quite a ways. Is that mountainous, or is that?
So they're not precisely because it's too expensive to dig wells. They're not, right? So this insurance precisely is designed knowing that they're not irrigated and they have to depend on rainfall.
Okay, but then, like, is that mountainous, or is that desert-like?
So here's what it looks like. So they're typically not growing on steep slopes. So we're talking about areas that are about 300 to 600 meters above sea level. So it's not, we're not at an altitude. And so primarily flat land. Population density, population pressure is not a big issue in these areas. So there's actually quite a bit of land available. And this is part of the problem that you guys are talking about, just soil quality. People, they'll use a plot for a couple of years and then switch over to another plot and build somewhere else, right? So so land is relatively abundant in these areas. And yeah, so they're basically growing in flat lands in between hills.